ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The story of the ancient Olympics is a story of strength, of stamina and speed, a story of endurance, of notable victories, of almost warlike feats of athletic daring. It's also the story of wet cheese.
Well, they ate wet cheeses, so they're kind of like feta. The modern feta cheese is probably the sort of thing that they ate. They just talk about wet cheese. I mean, it's probably goat's cheese or something like that. It's quite soggy when you eat it.
I'm Jonathan Green, and this is Every Bite from ABC Radio National. It's the show about food and the places where food, culture, science and history collide. This week, food for sport, high-performance eating. Constantine Panagiris is a lecturer in classics and ancient history at the University of Western Australia. And he has a particular interest in ancient health and medicine. So, if the diets of professional athletes begin with wet cheese, what comes next?
Well, we know that the diets changed a lot over time. So, later on, they changed to eating figs. There was a famous athlete called Croesus of Elis in around 776 BC who supposedly won a few victories just on a diet purely of figs. And then much later than that, a few centuries later, athletes started eating a meat diet. So they just purely ate meat, nothing else.
So the moist cheese period. What sort of activities were the athletes propelling themselves towards on that cheese diet?
Well, mostly the events that were in the ancient Olympics, so throwing javelin, running, lifting weights, throwing weights like discus or even just lumps of weight. But the main thing was just fast running, though. So for the first few Olympic competitions, it was only a running race.
That's quite a testament to the athletic powers of feta.
Actually, there's an author from, I think, the 2nd century AD who talks about how some of these athletes from the early period were really impressive because they managed to prolong their youth by eating this strict, healthy diets. He complained about how later athletes got into eating pastries and drinking too much wine. And he talks about how some of the later athletes had lots of fat around the belly, mainly from drinking too much alcohol and not following the advice of their trainers.
Constantine Panagiris from the University of Western Australia. Well, the advice of trainers and dietitians has become an integral part of sport today. And a diet of cheese and figs probably isn't what we imagine our modern athletes consuming. When I think of sports foods, I imagine optimised supplements, providing carefully calibrated doses of carbohydrates, protein and electrolytes, probably consumed as a flavourless gel sucked from a plastic tube. But it turns out the fundamental diet of a healthy athlete is the same as that of any healthy Australian.
Our food system in Australia, we're really lucky to have a really good food system, and we can get most of our vitamins and minerals from the food that we consume. So we always go food first as dietitians, and as sports dietitians, we always go person first, athlete second. I'm Dr. Kelly Stewart. I'm a senior lecturer and accredited sports dietitian at the Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane.
Kelly, is there one athletic diet that fits all?
Typically, we start with the Australian Guide to Healthy Eating, which gives everyone a good idea of how much of each of the five food groups they need, depending on their age. And then after that, different people need different things, and it depends on what kind of activity they're doing. So obviously someone that's training large volumes, 20, 30, 40 hours a week, need a very different diet to someone like me who, you know, does a couple of walks and a couple of runs and a couple of stationary bike rides a week. So
is it just a matter of quantity, or do we start to tweak various components of that diet depending on the activity of the athlete in question?
We can start with more of those things, whether it be fruits or vegetables or grains or whatever. But when you start getting up to high energy intakes, it's very hard to meet your energy requirements by just consuming whole foods, I suppose.
Right.
So it does start to get tweaked a bit as you get into those higher volumes of training. The other thing that comes into it, though, also is that some athletes, depending on their sport, will need to consume different types of things whilst they're actually training or competing. So it's difficult to, I don't know, if you're an ocean swimmer, for example, to eat a Vegemite sandwich, you know, they're going to rely more heavily on what we would call sports foods, so sports drinks or sports gels or things like that.
So let's set a ground line for this. The usual person, what sort of calorific intake is necessary just for common or garden life?
So typically you're looking at 8 or 9, 10,000 kilojoules for a everyday person. But again, that also depends on whether they're tall, like height comes into it as well, and then also whether they have a manual labour job. Someone like a labourer is going to need more anyway, and then you're probably getting up to 10, 11, 12,000 kilojoules. And then if you add training on top of that, it blows out completely for some people.
So the impression I'm getting, and I guess this applies most of the sort of elite and just below that level, is that this is a highly individualised business.
Absolutely, highly individualised. So like I said before, we can start with the basics of the five food groups. So if we were to look at a hierarchy of importance, the way I explain it to my students is we use a cupcake analogy, which came out of Professor Louise Burke, a cupcake with icing and sprinkles. And what it is a hierarchy. Normally, you wouldn't have sprinkles by itself. Normally, you wouldn't have icing by itself. So the cake itself makes up the core food groups. The icing is the sports drinks, the gels, the protein bars or protein supplements. And then on top of that, the sprinkles are what we previously would have called ergogenic aids. So the performance supplements, such as creatine or caffeine or sodium bicarb or something like that. So it needs to be done in that order, and you can't cheat your way to the sprinkles. You really need to build that base.
And the science is so interesting because you're actually, most people eat things not fully aware of what is then happening physiologically as a consequence of that intake. But that's not true for sports nutrition.
Well, I guess it depends on the type of athlete you are, what sport you participate in. So, you know, there's some really high profile sports where athletes receive a lot of support. And, you know, Cricket Australia is the perfect example. Cricket Australia have had a sports dietitian, an advanced sports dietitian, for a really long time now, and she's done amazing things with the Australian cricket team. So, but if you're in a unpopular, I suppose, sport, you may not necessarily have had access to this information. Typically, if you've got a bit of money, it goes to coaching, it goes to equipment, it goes to funding travel to go to competitions.
Cricket is sort of an interesting example because it's a sport in which you can clearly see the impact of this intervention. You know, the cricketers, say, 30 years ago were all shapes and sizes.
Absolutely, absolutely. Being a long-time cricket fan, having grown up at the Gabba on the dog track that went around the Gabba, a lot has changed since, you know, David Boone or... Yeah, the things that they used to do. I mean, Booney's record from Australia to London is quite famous.
And 28 cans, I think. Is that right?
Wow.
It's the stuff of legend.
It is absolutely. But I'm not sure that's what we should be promoting anymore. We've advanced so much in the world of sports science and sports nutrition, and I don't know whether Booney would survive in this day and age.
Possibly not. Although, you know, good hand eye will get you certain.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And look, and to be fair, that's the thing about batters, is that they don't have the physiological biomechanical requirements that a fast bowler has, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah.
Dr. Kelly Stewart, Senior Lecturer and Sports Dietitian at Queensland University of Technology. Actually, it was 52 beers that David Boone is said to have consumed en route to England in 1989, smashing batsman Doug Waters' record of 44 cans between Sydney and Heathrow in 1977. The Australians won back the Ashes in that 1989 series, and yes, apart from wicketkeeper Ian Healy, Booney took the highest number of catches and made 442 runs at 55.25. Cheers. You're listening to Every Bite from ABC Radio National. So, if a relatively healthy everyday diet provides an ideal foundation for most athletes, cricket presents an interesting case study in the integration of routine domesticity to high-level sport. Much of the players' eating takes place during the course of the game. True, your marathon runner might replenish their energy on the go, or a tennis player might down a banana between sets. But cricket is built around its meal breaks, lunch and tea. Perhaps more than any other sport, cricket has food on the brain.
If you ever listen to cricket's argo, there is a lot of food talk in the game. You know, you talk about hitting the ball off the meat of the bat, you chop the ball, you whip the ball, you cream the pie chuckers. Bowlers toss it up, they aim for bite, they use a cherry, they look to bowl a peach or a Jaffa. These are all things that it seemed to me to be designed to make you work up an appetite.
Gideon Haig is a writer and club cricketer whose journalism routinely displays an encyclopedic familiarity with the cultural history of cricket.
The game originates in the pastures of England, being played by shepherds. So, of course, they had, in theory, they had accessible food whenever they wanted it. And some were involved, some were looking on, some were celebrating. And, you know, everyone has a different sort of bodily rhythm and everyone requires replenishment at different times. It's kind of not surprising that over the journey that would formalise and concentrate in specified preordained time periods.
When in formal cricketing settings, when lunch became a thing, what was the typical fare?
Well, I guess meat and also sandwiches. You know, you're looking for that ideal sort of portable meal that can be prepared earlier, that requires the minimum of preparation on a particular day. You can pack it in the morning. You can take the leftovers away at the end of a day's play.
It's not fair necessarily designed, sculpted around high athletic performance.
And
that idea of athleticism is a relatively newcomer to cricket.
Yes. Well, it's also a communal activity, isn't it? It was often, the village played it, the club played it. It was a gathering together of the community. And one of the ways in which the community also celebrates itself is to break bread, and sometimes to break bread with the opposition as well. The institution of the afternoon tea or the lunch with your opponent, which you provide as the home team, is something that even now is common in club cricket in Australia.
So, but even above club cricket, if we were at Lord's for a test match, for example, the home of the game, lunch is potentially a shared meal?
Yes, it is, yeah. And Lord's is actually famous on the circuit for having the best lunches. Even for the journalists, the spread is quite lavish. Everyone looks forward to a Lord's test. A huge smorgasbord is served up, a main meal at lunchtime, and cakes and tarts and biscuits at tea. You very seldom need to eat after a day's play at Lord's.
Do the team dietitians hover?
They do. And in fact, there was a famous example in 2013-14 of the English team sending out to Australia a specified menu that had to be provided at Australian venues. And it was so extensive, it was so detailed, it was so micromanaged by the dietitians, it was so esoteric, the halloumi cutlets that had to be cooked to a particular specific consistency, that it was leaked to the Daily Telegraph and the subject of mockery for the entire tour as Australia mowed England down 5-0. They were reminded constantly that we'd given you the food that you'd asked for and it had made no difference at all.
Australia, England, though, by and large, have a sort of a cultural affinity around food.
Yeah.
Australia, India, perhaps a slight disparity yes. in yes, what might course, be expected.
Well, yes. I mean, and of course, I think Indian teams abroad always suffered with the fact that they were majority vegetarian. I remember reading some descriptions of the Indian team going on tour to England in 1967. It was, you know, it was corned beef and salad at every single venue. And of course, gradually over the course of the tour, the Indians almost starved.
Fading away.
Fading away, as indeed did their performances.
I mean, this is the thing, that the changing nature of the cricketer must be reflected, I suspect, in the food offerings that attend their games.
They're probably more cosmopolitan than they used to
and
be.
And very diet yes. conscious, I'd imagine. Yes, they are now athletes.
Diet conscious too, but exposed to a greater variety of cuisines around the world. I mean, when Australian teams used to tour India and Pakistan, it was a genuine hardship posting, and the players were sent on their way with admonitions not to sample the local cuisine, particularly if it was undercooked.
Well, famously, Shane Warne, during the 1998 tour of India, sent an emergency appeal back home for a shipment of baked beans.
Warne believes he's wasting away. Skipper Mark Taylor, then Steve Waugh, and Ricky Ponting have all been laid low with Delhi Belly. The difference is Warne's health is fine. He simply won't try the Indian cuisine. He's a bowler worried about the runs. Warne's apparently been surviving largely on a diet of Indian naan bread and, yes, Vegemite that somebody secreted in the kit bag. A wholesome meal, if a little bland, but what Warne wants, Warne gets. Good old Queensland beans and spaghetti coming up. One of the big beans bakers, quick to seize a great moment in marketing, has a load going on the first flight tomorrow. The food parcel provides each member of the touring party with enough beans and spaghetti to see them through the tour.
I mean, even further back, I mean, 1959-60, I think four of the Australian team came home with hepatitis from that tour, and Gavin Stevens and Gordon Rourke never played for Australia again, and Gavin Stevens almost died from sampling the local cuisine. So certain superstitions evolved while they were there, that you never ate anything that wasn't cooked, you never brushed your teeth or drank with the local water.
Whiskey is the preferred.
Whiskey was the preferred thing to swill out your mouth with. And Ken Barrington, the England player of the 1950s and 60s, famously went on tours of the subcontinent eating nothing but egg and chips every night, because he said there's nothing they can do to egg and chips, and he never got sick.
Are any foods off limits, perhaps through superstition?
Duck.
Well, that makes sense.
Yes.
Duck, of course, is a zero score for a batsman. Where does that come from, that association?
Well, just the duck's egg. The shape of the score is the shape of a duck's egg. Famous story during a test match at Lord's in 1982, Robin Jackman, David Gower and Alan Lamb all went out to dinner. They all sort of dared each other to order breast of canard, and the next morning they all got out for ducks. I think
the lesson is
clear. Gower said afterwards that he'd never previously been superstitious, but now he saw a certain sense in it.
Writer, journalist, cricketer Gideon Haigh. Well, cricketers are not the only sports people that adhere to food-related superstitions. A sport that comes with its own dietary needs and traditions is sumo, the national sport of Japan. Wrestlers, or rikishi, of course have to eat extraordinary amounts to reach their imposing size. But during a tournament, they can get very particular about their protein.
The superstitious ones don't eat pork, don't eat beef during a tournament, because chickens have two legs and rikishi fight on two legs. If they fall down, they lose. So if they ended up being like a four-legged animal, they'll be on all fours.
Murray Johnson has been calling sumo tournaments for NHK, Japan's national broadcaster, for nearly 30 years. He's originally from Perth. So how does a bloke from Western Australia come to be calling sumo in Japan?
So I was doing Aussie football, cricket, golf when I was in Australia for different radio stations. When I came to Japan, they just opened up the English coverage of sumo. And seeing I had some sporting ability on my CV in terms of commentator, they asked me if I'd do sumo.
I've just arrived in your city and you're explaining sumo to me. What do you say?
The objective is to either push the person out, the opponent out, or push them down. the only parts of the body that are allowed to touch the dohyo, the clay, the sand, are the bottom of your feet. If your feet turn over and the top of your foot touches the clay, you lose. But normally the idea is to push them down or push them out, whether it be by grabbing the hold of the mawashi, the belt, or by using a thrusting, pushing attack to push the opponent out and or down.
And these are worlds colliding. These are big men.
The average weight of the 42 men in the top division is 157 kilos. And the average height is 183 centimetres. So you do have men on the very lower end of the scale, around 117 kilos, and to the average person, that sounds like a lot. But when they're up against the very big men on the dohyo, they look tiny.
They train hard?
They train 7 days a week.
So they train hard, but they must also eat hard.
Yeah, that's probably the one most expensive things for every oyakata, the head of each stable. The bill they have to pay for the food. So they eat about 10,000 calories a day. The average person normally is somewhere in the 2,000 range. And a lot of that is rice, but the main staple, of course, is chanko nabe.
Now, chanko nabe, we must talk about that. What is that dish? What's in it?
Well, chanko nabe is basically a pot stew. Normally in your home chanko nabe, it would be in a beautiful ceramic dish. But in sumo stables, they're huge pots, and there would be two or three of them on the stove. Initially, it has dashi, which is basically water thrown in with a little bit of salt or soy sauce or whatever they choose to use. And the dashi could be a combination of different tastes, midden, miso, soy sauce. Then they'll throw in the meat. Normally, it's chicken, pork, and fish. There is beef, but that is not eaten on a regular basis as much as the other three items. But it's normally chicken and pork. Then they'll add all the vegetables. You add the hardy vegetables initially, carrots and all those things, a daikon radish. There could be a abarage tofu, which is that fried tofu. They would add that late. And every stable has its own recipe.
It's quite extraordinary. And what sort of quantities would each wrestler eat?
Well, they would eat as much as they want. They eat 10 bowls of rice.
Right.
Invariably, the first thing they do after having this big meal is sleep. And that's to gain fat. Because if you have a massive meal of 10,000 calories, the idea is to build up your body. Now, the amount of training they do is the reason that these men are so... Some people say they don't look healthy, but they're extremely fit.
Has there ever been a wrestler that's broken the mold, that has competed with a lean but large and muscular body?
Yeah. The man that comes to mind is what the man they called the Wolf, whose name was Chonofuji. Now, the only reason he got to be so big and muscular, his shoulder kept popping out. So he built up and built up and built up. And he was, they say muki muki in Japanese, he was just extremely muscular and very popular back in the 80s. And he went on to become a coach and unfortunately died quite young. But the big ones, they try to lose weight when they retire, and some have done that effectively because they're no longer doing that training that helps their metabolism. Once they stop training and they keep eating as much, that's a quick path to death.
I mean, we've all seen former footballers who become quite large. I imagine this is also true for sumos, and it's a diet that isn't going to stand you in good stead if you're not doing that exercise.
Well, the other thing is they're told to eat this food. They don't necessarily want to eat it. It's their coach wants them to maintain weight. Some of them can't put on the weight, so they continue. A lot of the Europeans that come to Japan and fight here, they struggle to put on a lot of weight, the skinny ones that turn up. I mean, we've had pencil-thin top division performers, but they get thrown around like a rag doll. So they've got to get skillful to the extent that weight isn't the issue for them. Technique is. So a little tiny guy, we say tiny, 117 kilos, can beat a 200-kilo man with technique.
Sumo wrestling commentator Murray Johnson, and you can hear him calling the grand sumo tournaments on NHK World. So, what I'm learning from each of today's guests is that when it comes to an athlete's diet, everything is relative. Whether you're winning back the ashes after an unfathomable amount of beer, or competing in the Olympics on a diet of cheese and figs. The factors that dictate the right diet and the right training routine are innumerable. Take, for example, the sumo wrestler's diet, which aims for an intake of around 10,000 plus calories per day. At the height of his power, that same amount of daily energy was consumed by a man who weighed about half that of the average sumo wrestler, the most successful Olympian of all time, the American swimmer Michael Phelps. Let's ask sports dietitian Kelly Stewart, is that an excessive amount for an athlete to consume?
Well, no, not when you're Michael Phelps. He would have been training astronomical numbers of hours a week. He's also a really tall fella. If you have such a high muscle mass, you have such a high training load, 10,000 calories, 42,000 kilojoules is more than appropriate for someone like that. They've done studies on Tour de France cyclists during the tour. They worked out that they were consuming over 35,000 kilojoules every day during the tour, and half of that was taken in on the bike. So it's not uncommon for tall, high-performing males that are training hard to consume that amount of kilojoules.
So a Tour de France cyclist, perfectly entitled for a cheesy baguette and a glass of wine at the end of the stage?
I don't know about the glass of wine, but they would consume baguettes in truckloads.
You say the wine, no. Is that just because it's pretty much junk calories?
Most athletes at that sort of level probably could take or leave alcohol a lot of the time. They don't pound their bodies that much and for that length of time to then turn around and put alcohol into it. It's not great for lots of different processes within the body. You're right, it is, empty calories, but it's also just has, you know, massive effects on the body. It also, I mean, the other thing about alcohol is it stops us from doing the recovery habits that we should be doing. I mean, I think probably one glass of wine is okay for some people, but
if consumed in an ice bath.
Yeah, well, maybe ice bath, glass of wine, sounds all right.
So there we have it. You and I may be more sumo than Michael Phelps, more boony than an ancient Olympian. But the thing we should all have in common is that common or garden, eat your veggies, get your food groups, sensible, balanced diet. That's the formula for athletic performance and ordinary living. Every Bite is your weekly journey to the places where food, culture, science and history collide. Every bite tells a story, and I hope you're enjoying these highlights from our last year together. It's all part of the Radio National Summer. Today, we were reacquainted with Constantine Panagiotis, Kelly Stewart, Murray Johnson, and our resident cricket tragic, Gideon Haigh. Speaking of cricket, hope you've been enjoying this year's Summer of Cricket on ABC Grandstand. What a series. And if the Olympic Games are more your speed, Winter Olympics, they kick off in Italy this February. Or sumo. Of course, the January tournament kicks off on the 12th. Highlight streaming on NHK World, if you didn't know. Every Bite is made on Wurundjeri country and produced by sumo fanatic Kim Jurek. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.